Good afternoon. So last time we started talking about kind of Rust systematic rules for sort of ensuring we don't have things like use after free bugs. So we had this single owner rule as kind of our starting point. And we mentioned that like this works, it's pretty simple, but it's pretty impractical because we can't like take references to things. We have to move values around all the time. Not very convenient. So we extended that to allow this kind of borrowing where we'd kind of act as if we move the object around as far as our bookkeeping goes, but we'd actually take references. And then we extended that further to allowing multiple readers and one writer at a time. We didn't allow multiple writers because with many cases where we have objects that internally contain pointers, we have problems if we're writing and reading at the same time, where we read a pointer and start using it and the pointer changes from under us. That's exactly kind of a use after free bug. So to allow our objects to kind of internally contain pointers, which is very common for things like, ArrayList equivalents, we kind of, need to have this, rule that there's multiple readers or one writer, I should say. And we mentioned that these rules, they're conservative. They make sure that we're safe in terms of no use after free bugs and so on, but they don't make sure that we are allowed to do everything that we should be allowed to do. There's things that are, definitely actually safe that can't cause problems that they prohibit. Okay. So, one side note, so I had some anonymous feedback saying, hey, please talk about web exploitation. And I guess if you looked at the schedule, I've kind of moved these topics as, these were topics for kind of tentative at the beginning of the semester, and I've leaned away from doing that. And basically my thought on this, and like how I arrived at this decision, and I could try to like fit some of these things in, but I'm not sure they're what people are thinking of when we say how to exploit web programs. So the major topics are cross-site scripting, which I believe you've all seen in 3710, and CSRF, which some of you have seen in 3710 and some of you have not, I think. But those are kind of our major topics, and I don't want to just cover XSS again, because I'm pretty sure you've seen that. And if I cover CSRF, it probably ends up being relatively brief. I can imagine some other areas that would be worth kind of more detail, but the things that come up as obvious topics in those areas possibly aren't what you're really thinking of when you're thinking of let's learn how to exploit web applications. So like one is like, what do we do? Like, what is the difference between our proof of concept of cross-site scripting and how it's actually dangerous? How do we prove it actually is gonna get us into trouble, and therefore probably talking and kind of mitigations for XSS. So if we don't really solve XSS, what are things we can do to make it less impactful? But that's kind of a rather, not the super exciting topic in that area, I think, but there's stuff that I can do there. There's a big area of when we have web pages embedding other web pages, how do we make sure that that's still secure? If I have, a gadget from some other website on my website, or we share logins or something, like what's the security in that? And also relatedly, how do I safely host user-generated content on my website without that turning into the XSS problem? And then there's things which seem a little tangential to kind of exploiting web applications, like browser extension security, just, I think, a big important area, including relatively recently, but probably not what people were thinking of. And things which I think aren't really this class, like web tracking and privacy, which I think is a very interesting topic, but not exploiting web applications, really. And sort of making exploits work across a network, but that seems like more of like we're talking about how the networking side of the functionality works, which to me has an uncomfortable overlap with the networking class. So that's my thoughts. Like, I think some of these probably are reasonable candidates, and I'll try to think about if there's a good way of fitting them, but like, I think this is not what people are thinking of when they say, please teach about web exploitation. This is maybe not what would excite them. Covered it, or if we did, you know, kind of a review of XSS and kind of brief coverage of CSRF. It's probably not the exciting part of that. But that's my thoughts on that. I definitely see the idea of like, oh, we should be teaching about web security. That's like specifically web security, but these are kind of our specifically web security topics that I can think of. We'll have some things we'll talk about later, which arguably can be applied to web security. We've seen some before, but you know, something like command injection, you know, that applies to any application, not just the web. So questions on this? Yeah, and I guess something I don't have right is XSS mitigations could be a full topic, but I don't think that's what people are really excited about when we think of exploitable web applications. Okay, so back to talking about Rust. So we're going to talk about doing things that go beyond what Rust's sort of full borrowing rules allow. And to talk about that, I'm going to talk a bit about some preliminaries of things that Rust supports that are either parallel to those borrowing rules or kind of or supplement to them in some way. And one thing Rust supports that will be familiar to you if you've programmed in C++ is Rust has destructors. And the way this works is here I have a struct example that happens to be empty, but it has a drop function, and when the example object is dropped, when it goes out of scope, that function automatically runs. And this is taking advantage of the fact that the compiler needs to track its lifetime anyways. So it takes advantage of that and inserts a call to drop it when it goes out of scope. So in this example, it goes out of scope here. That's when the drop function runs. And in C++, for those of you who've used C++, you might know that this is very similar to what happens if you have a destructor, which is written with a tilde in C++, because they like obscure characters, I guess. But this would be very similar to if you had a destructor method. It would run at the same time in C++. So this is like not something new that Rust is doing, but it's something you probably haven't seen very much because you usually use languages with garbage collection where we don't have predictable times for functions like this to run. And this applies kind of, this works when objects are moved around. So in this example, I have a T example, and this moves T into Q. So we only have the destruction of Q. T is not destroyed, it's moved away. So question?
I'm not super familiar with like the C++ destructor. Is that just like what the weak does, or what does that mean?
Is that just what the
weak keyword, like what is the destructor?
What is the destructor? So the destructor is automatically run when an object is destroyed. And it doesn't matter if the object is destroyed by using the delete keyword, which is like free, or by going out of scope naturally.
Okay.
So if I have this C++ class example, and I have some function where I declare an instance of example, like our main, the destructor will run when that foo function x returns. Just like in our Rust example, when t goes out of scope, the drop function automatically runs. So this is the same feature in C++. I don't expect people to have done much C++, but I know that's much more likely than having done much Rust. So that's why I'm mentioning it. And also to point out that most of the things we've seen in Rust are things that people have done in other languages, we're just having a little more compiler support for it. So here, the object is moved, so the destructor, so there's actually only one instance, and it just moves from T to Q. So we only run the destructor once. If we have two copies, it will run separately for each one. So here I have T, and I make a clone of the object, so an actual copy. Copying the empty object is pretty trivial, but you know that makes a difference as far as whether we consider it two separate examples or one. So the usefulness of this feature is that this is how Rust is going to kind of automate memory management, because we want to, you know, not just like track when objects are used, we want to get rid of them. And for dynamically allocated things, we need to like run code to like delete objects. This functionality is going to let us do that. And importantly, we'll do that in a way where the compiler will say there's an error if we're trying to drop something and it's still in use. That's a borrowing problem, right? We're borrowing an object for too long. It's going to say, hey, you can't keep that thing around. It goes away. And this pattern, if you've used quote unquote modern C++, you will have seen C++ people call this idea resource acquisition is initialization, where we basically have objects that wrap some resource, like memory, where when we make the object, it allocates that, and when the object gets free, goes out of scope, it gets freed automatically. So this idea has been popular in C++ since before Rust existed, and is presumably what they're copying. And you hardly haven't seen it much in other languages because it doesn't really work in a garbage collected language, where we don't have things getting going out of scope, doesn't trigger a function to run automatically generally. And an example of something that uses this pattern is vec, right? That's the equivalent of ArrayList or vector in C++. And it kind of wraps a malloc memory and handles automatically freeing that memory when the vec goes out of scope. And the simplest version of this in Rust is there's something called box, which is kind of like a vec with one element. It's a heap allocated object. If you've used quote unquote modern C++, it's similar to something in C++ called unique pointer. And to give an example of that, this is kind of our equivalent of malloc and free in Rust. So if I want to allocate a 32-bit integer dynamically, like in C++, I use malloc. In Rust, I create a box object and set its initial value. This is actually probably equivalent to setting its initial value to 0, though that's probably an important step. And then I can kind of use that like a reference to modify the dynamically allocated memory, just like I'd use the resulting pointer. And because this box has a drop method registered, when it goes out of scope, it automatically gets freed. But if we return it, it doesn't, because it gets moved out of the function. So this is taking advantage of that kind of tracking, where when does this box object actually go out of scope, or does it get moved away? We're doing that same tracking to know when to call free, and the Rust compiler can automatically do this. And as I mentioned, this is something that's actually not new to Rust. You have the same functionality in C++ with unique pointer. So we have this kind of built-in functionality. Well, mentioned that kind of we're leading up to, we want to do things that kind of the default rules don't allow us to do. And Rust lets you do this with the unsafe keyword. So Rust actually gives us access to kind of the raw C functionality that does all these unsafe things. And most importantly, this is used to implement things like vec. Like, we can't write vec without some special code to manipulate pointers. That code just is written in Rust. We just have to mark it as unsafe because, you know, that code's doing dangerous things like allocating memory and moving things into it when it's not initialized correctly, and like resizing the memory while there's stuff in it in a way that's hard for the compiler to prove is safe. So vec is implemented in Rust, and we have this struct with something that wraps a pointer, basically, and a length. And for example, here's the truncate method, and it has this unsafe block where it's getting an item and calling the drop method on it in place and decrementing the length. And because we're doing, you know, getting, dropping objects, and we don't want to make sure they're at the right time, that's something the compiler doesn't just let you do. You have to, like, do this in this unsafe block. Or to give maybe a more interesting example, the push method is, you know, appends to the vector, so it needs to grow it. So how does this work? It gets the length of the vector, and the length is different than the capacity of the internal buffer. So if the length is larger than the internal buffer, sorry, is equal to the capacity of the internal buffer, we need to grow it. And once we've done that check, then it actually does kind of the unsafe pointer arithmetic. That we've checked is in bounds with the code above. But that we have it marked as unsafe because the compiler doesn't automatically know that that's okay to do. But we know from the context that this can't be out of bounds, but you know, it's not actually checked. It's just doing pointer math like we would normally do in C. Some questions on this kind of escape hatch idea? And the idea is that the vec class is listed, so even though it has this unsafe code that hopefully the interface is designed so there's no way of using it to actually cause unsafe things to happen, for this push function, you know, kind of the reasoning for that, as long as this length is accurate, you know, and as long as this grow one function actually makes the capacity bigger, we're never going out of bounds. And we have to kind of look carefully at all the functions to make sure that that happens. And you might say, so what is going on with this asmute pointer? So Rust gives us access to raw pointers if we want them. So here I have a vector of four numbers, and I get a raw pointer to the first element of the vector. And this is stored as an array, just like in C. And you know, that pointer is a memory address. So if I output it, colon question mark is in the debugging format, I can see the address, and I can dereference that, but since it's a pointer, this is unsafe. It's not checking that that's a valid thing to access, so I have to tell the compiler, please let me dereference it, even though you can't prove that this doesn't do a use after free, or something like that. And I can also do pointer arithmetic on it. I can add one, which in this case adds one U32, so we get the next element of the vector. I can also, because it's a mutable pointer, I can also use it to set a value, and that changes, in this case, the first element of the vector to 11. As I mentioned, that this is marked as unsafe because we don't have our protections. The compiler's not doing any checking here for use after free stuff. This is the mechanism to implement things like VEC that, you know, are too complicated for the simple borrowing rules. So here, for example, I have this pointer, mutable pointer Z, that I extract by using a raw pointer to get it. And I told the compiler, I know this is unsafe, how I'm getting that reference to Z. And I got that reference unsafely. It's not safe to use, even though the code that uses it, I don't have to mark as unsafe. But because I did something unsafe, and if that code is quote unquote wrong, it's not enforcing that the value remains sort of valid, the compiler happily accepts it because I told it to do it and lets me access free memory. And we get this crazy value down here for when we access what Z references. Questions about this example here? So, a big thing I'm trying to point out here is that when we do something that's marked as unsafe in a language like Rust, like often the sort of actual dangerous effects of that are not in the unsafe code, but much later. Yes. And I guess also with raw pointers, just like in C, I can, you know, say allocate memory and cast between pointers and integers and different pointer types. I can get pointers to invalid addresses. So here I get the address I got for malloc, and I add 1 to it, which is adding 1 to the address, so I'm adding 1 byte. And when I try to dereference that in debug mode, I get a, that's not aligned. All U32s are at a multiple of 4 address. In release mode, that gives me this value that mixes these two things I put in my malloc memory. I put 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in hex and 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You know, and if I access that unaligned, I get this kind of mixed number. Yeah, we can do that with our unsafe keyboard. So this is kind of our internal mechanism that we're going to see used to implement kind of tool policies that don't work with our normal bar. And there's one other tool that exists that I want to mention because it's going to show up in a future example, future demonstration, and I want to, like, what's going on. So we talked about having things that are marked as mutable or not mutable. But that's, you know, often not going to match what we want to do. We often want to have an object that conceptually shouldn't change, but internally it needs to do some changes. And there's a tool for this in Rust called cell, which lets us have something that's immutable, but lets us something in an immutable struct, but we can change a field of the struct. But we mentioned that we had this issue of, like, if we get a pointer, the pointer might go be reallocated somewhere else. How do we make sure that's okay? The solution for cell is that we can only get out a copy of that value. So there's no worrying about having pointers that change. We're always just getting a copy. And as an example of why we might use this, here I have a struct where I have some big vector of items, and I compute something on that that's kind of expensive, and I want to cache the value. So we're not changing the value that's conceptually in our struct example when I compute that and cache it, but we still want to store it. And the cell is a tool that lets us implement that kind of cache without marking it as mutable. So now that we have kind of our preliminaries, I'm going to show you some things in Rust that are kind of our usable escape hatches for doing things that we really can't do with normal borrowing. You know, so cases where that doesn't work out. And this is going to give us, going to show you things where we get a reference-like object, which you'll often hear called a smart pointer, where the idea is that we're going to have something we can use like a reference, but it's going to implement some more complicated borrowing rules to handle a situation that normal borrowing doesn't understand. And we'll have an explicit example in a minute. And this example is going to be with an alternate rule that is more complicated than borrowing. We're going to implement a rule called reference counting. And the idea of reference counting is that we have some object, and we don't want to have a single owner. We want to have multiple owners. But we want to make sure we don't delete the object too early. So how do we do this? We track how many owners the object currently has, how many references there are. And whenever we make a new reference, we increment that count. Whenever a reference goes away, that is, we have the drop function for the reference we called, we decrement that count. And when the count goes to zero, we delete it, actually getting rid of the memory. And REST provides this with the RC type. And the RC type is going to be something that we can use as if it's a reference. So to give an example of that, here I have these RC strings, which are kind of like a reference to a string. And you can see here, I make S2 be one of these counted references to strings that points to the string example. And then I set S1 to be a new reference pointing to that. So we have S1 points to, and S2 points to our example string. And I also have sref kind of points to example, but is borrowed from S1. And we see we can access all of these, but the way this is made safe, how do we make sure that we, aren't going to access this at the wrong time, is that internally we're tracking a count of how many references there are to the object. So in this case, we have two references through RCs. The one not through an RC, that's just borrowed from an RC, so we don't have to track a count separately because we know that S2 stays around long enough for S1 ref to be okay to use. And then, it stays from S1, which is still around, so we know it's okay to use. And I got the count wrong. I didn't show the output correctly. Then when our S2 goes out of scope, what I was meant to write here, our count gets decremented. And why is that happening? Because the compiler implicitly calls the drop method on S2, and that decrements that count. And that's what happens there. What is happening here? Why? Interesting. And apparently its keyboard input to the presenter viewer doesn't work, Daddy, which is fun. Interesting. There we go. Okay. So let's give another example here. So here I have my same situation where I have two references through RC through the same string. And did I do this wrong? I did do this wrong, did I? Yes, I changed the code I tested and not this code. And, okay, so I need to edit this slide as to sref equals star s2. So this, I made a copy-paste error. So this is supposed to be sref equals a reference to s2, and this results in an error where if we do that, it says, no, if you make sref, if this s2 here, when you make a get a normal reference from it, it has to last long enough for that normal reference to be okay. Right. So what we're doing is we have this kind of wrapper for a reference, and we can borrow from the wrapper temporarily to get a normal reference and just use that normal reference. But if we try to borrow for too long, like if this is S2, then we're going to get this error saying that, hey, you borrowed, but you tried to use that after S2 went away. But normally, we'll keep track of our references, you know, our references in these counted objects, and that will allow us to have as many references as we like, as long as there are all RCs. And we can have them have all different lifetimes, because the compiler will figure out at runtime, not the compiler, the program will figure out at runtime when to actually delete the object. So we can turn this into a real reference, and the borrowing rule ensures that when we do that, it doesn't matter that we got a real reference, the compiler is going to enforce that it doesn't, that it sticks around only an acceptable amount of time. But importantly, this means that we don't have to change all our code to pass RCs around. We can call code that uses normal references, and it should mostly just work. So as an example here, I have my hypothetical, I have a grade class that has is referenced by students and assignments. And this violates our single owner rule. But I can deal with that by providing these both with an RC reference to our grade, and that will ensure when the student or assignment goes away, you know, we won't actually delete the corresponding grade object until both references to it go away. And when we want to actually access the grade, we can just get a reference to it if we really want one, a normal reference, or we can modify things through that. Not modify, we can read things through the RC object. So questions on this use? See? And I guess something that's worth pointing out is that here, I'm accessing the score field without converting to a normal reference. Ref explicitly. So they're basically the RC class is set up to implicitly convert to the thing it contains, just for your convenience. So we could make a normal reference to access the score field, but we don't have to do that. We can just say, access the score field, and it's going to figure out, okay, what you want to do is you want to get a reference to this grade and then access the score field, and the compiler will do that for us, you know, without us typing as much. So a limitation here is that this RC idea only gives us references to read-only objects. It's a pretty big limitation. And that's because we can't use this idea to enforce the only one mutable reference idea, right? We said when we're borrowing, we have to make sure there's only one mutable reference to an object. We aren't doing the bookkeeping to know that that's true. So we just have immutable references. And the other thing is that this prevents use after free, but it doesn't prevent memory use. If we have an object that references back, we'll have a problem. So if this grade had a reference to the assignment instead of its name, then we would never have the count go down to zero, because there'd always be a reference indirectly, and therefore we would end up with a memory leak. And Russ' idea is that that's okay, we can have memory leaks, because that's still not going to cause an exploit. you might say, well, isn't the denial of service kind of an exploit? Good argument, but they didn't think it was high enough priority when designing the language. Now, if you have circular references, there's a way of marking things that are circular references. There's this variant of RC called weak, where it doesn't increment the count. And the way that works is when you have a weak, you call this upgrade function, and it either gives you a normal RC object, or it says, hey, the thing went away because the count went to zero. But, you know, this allows you to avoid memory leaks, but it doesn't automatically do it. You have to think about, when do I want to use weak versus RC? And if you do it wrong, you'll have a memory leak. Or you'll have this, the object went away and it shouldn't have happening when you don't like. So we've seen this RC idea, and this is kind of a general mechanism where we can use the same mechanism used to implement RC to implement other policies, and I'll give one more example. So we can make this new thing that acts like a reference, and we get callbacks on ownership ending because that drop function, so we can automatically do our bookkeeping. And the compiler enforces that we don't get told, hey, it's no longer in use, when it isn't really because of the borrowing rules. And also, we can make sure copying implicitly isn't allowed. So you saw with RC, we had to explicitly call this clone function to make a copy. And kind of the implementation of RC, it is REST code, and this is my approximate version of it. I've omitted some extra stuff. But basically, what we're keeping around is two counts, a count of strong references and a count of weak ones in these mutable fields. And that's what we're, you know, storing a pointer to in the RC. And as an example, cloning one of these is returning a new pointer and incrementing the count. You know, that's what the clone method does. And our drop method is decrementing the count. And if the count is now zero, you know, doing the actual work of freeing up memory and so on. And we mentioned we did this thing where it acts like a reference to T. Well, there's just a special trait you can implement that the compiler automatically uses. And that's how we did that grade.score for an RC object. And this is very like something that if you've done a lot of, you've seen C++ that's used in, you know, kind of quote unquote, a modern style, you will have seen in the form of something called shared pointer. It's basically the same thing as RC, except with shared pointer, when you get a normal pointer out of it, nothing's stopping you from using after freeing that. With REST, you get those warnings saying, hey, you're taking this pointer you got out of this RC, you keep using it when the RC goes away. And also, we showed this reference counting strategy, and if you looked at other programming languages, or even big projects, this is very common. This strategy appears everywhere, and this is just an implementation of a very common memory management strategy, just with the extra support to make sure it's harder to screw up getting the counts wrong. So for example, the Linux kernel uses this all the time, but they do it by hand, and sometimes they've messed up and have used after free bugs because they don't have as much didn't have as much compiler help to make sure you're always decrementing when the thing goes away and incrementing when it doesn't, and so on. Also, a bunch of programming languages this is how normal references work. So Rust could have made that decision, that they could have said that our normal references would keep account, but they didn't do that because it's not zero overhead, right? We said the motivation for Rust was that they were trying to fit the niche that C and C++ have, and to do that, we need to have kind of our default case not have the extra overhead of like keeping track of counts. But some other programming languages have said, like Python and Swift have said, that's not a problem. We can just keep counts. No big deal. Some questions? Okay. So we talked about sort of RC as a way of having multiple references to something, but they were read-only. You might say, how do we have references that aren't read-only? And we're going to talk about ref cells that implement a rule to do this. And basically, they're enforcing the only one mutable copy at a time, but they're doing it by keeping a count. So same idea as RC, but we instead of keeping a count of total references, we keep a count of read-only or non-read-only references. And we make sure the count of non-read-only references is only set to 1 if there's no read-only ones, and that's it. And so refcell gives us this interface, but we have to explicitly either borrow a mutable value or borrow an immutable value. And for example, in this case, you know, I have x, y, and z that are wrapped in this ref cell, so I have this pointer to a potentially shared value. And when I try to have this function run such that we're going to access a value for writing and reading at the same time, it's a runtime error. It's not a compile time error because the function's being called perfectly fine. At runtime, we're going to figure out, wait a moment, you know, you can't, you already have this as a mutable borrow, you can't have it as an immutable borrow. And so that's kind of the implementation. And you might say, how does this know that I've borrowed this object for here? Well, the answer is that this isn't a reference, x value here. X value is a type like RC that we can use like a reference, but it's not a real reference. Instead, it's some class which has a drop method. In particular, it's this refmute class that has a custom drop method that keeps track of this number here, which is, you know, tells us, are there readers right now, or is there a writer? And we just check at runtime whether, you know, that's okay. So questions about this ref cell idea? So that's kind of the idea of how Rust still works. So we have an assignment that uses Rust. You might use RC in it. You probably won't use refcell, but I talked about it because it seems really weird to say, hey, we have something like pointers, but you can't write to them. So we're going to give you a Rust program that uses unsafe and raw pointers. And your job is to fix it so it doesn't do that. And probably this will require a redesign of part of the code. There's kind of two strategies that are recommended in hints. So one is that we have some pointers between data structures where instead we could look up by an ID number and a map. And that avoids having multiple pointers to something. So that's one solution to the problem. Another is that we have some objects which have multiple references. We could use RC for them. They're read-only, so you don't need to worry about making them mutable. If you needed to make them mutable, you could combine RC with refcell. We have an example in the assignment, but you know, I want to just you know about that concept. That would be kind of the idea there. questions on kind of my preview of the assignments. Okay. So one other thing I'll mention about Rust that I just want you to know exists is about databases. So this is another thing that Rust is trying to prevent, is trying to make it so you can't accidentally write databases. And a big reason for this is that they particularly don't want databases that cause use after free bugs, because this is one cause of use after free bugs, is we have a data race, so a threading error. Because not all of you have taken CSO2, we're definitely not going to go into, we have some different levels of sort of threading understanding. But, you know, the idea is that we want to, like, support, you know, checking that when we're checking for whether there's multiple users of an object, we also take into account different threads using an object. And one case where this might seem problematic is that if we think of what our increment, the reference count thing does, that's not actually safe to just do in two different threads if it's implemented in kind of the naive way. And if we want to implement it in a way that's safe for multiple threads, it's going to be more complicated and slower. And what Russ said is that, well, we don't want extra overhead from making it safe for multiple threads. So Rust has said the RC type only works with a single thread. But then the question is, how do we keep you from using it with multiple threads? And Rust's solution is that they mark value, whether values can be shared between threads explicitly. So part of the type says, is this something that you're allowed to use in multiple threads? And the RC class is marked as not safe. And there's a companion class called ARC that is safe, but it's safe because it does extra work internally to make sure it works with multiple threads. And this notably is not the decision that C++ made with SharePointer. With SharePointer, if you use SharePointer, you're opting into the extra overhead of handling multiple threads, even if your program is single-threaded. We focused on how Rust enforces use after free. I think it's worth mentioning that this idea of kind of customizing our programming language to make it harder to write dangerous code, there's probably other applications that we could explore for that and or are being explored in research. So one example is we like have problems where we have, you know, data going to the wrong place. Like, and this is something we can imagine enforcement mechanisms in the same kind of idea as borrowing, where the compiler somehow tracks where your data goes, where you could imagine the language enforcing you don't do certain things. And this might be something that's built into a new language, or might be something that we can implement on top of an existing language. Sensitive data, we can also imagine trying to implement things like, oh, I want to make sure the runtime is constant so there's no side channel attacks, those sorts of things. But I think this is kind of an open area that, you know, in your careers there might be sort of more things that are the same idea as Rust. You want to make a language where it's harder to screw up. It's not going to be easier to use, but it's going to enforce some properties, some rules that are going to keep us from having insecure code. Also, I guess I'll mention that there are other types of kind of smart pointers besides the ones we saw in Rust. We saw RC, reference counting, refcell for I want to have a shared object that can be written to, but not multiple at a time. We saw box. There's also some stuff for dealing with threads. And there's like, for example, there's some other cases like one cell is, I want to set a value once that's shared. How do I do that safely? One cell is a solution for that. Some questions? Okay. So I think it's probably worth revisiting our, do I have that? Yeah. Our zero overhead assumption. The normal case indeed has zero overhead. Does the other stuff have zero overhead? Maybe not. It definitely doesn't. And also, like, there's definitely a real trade-off here as far as programmer complexity. Right? There's a lot of extra complexity on the programmer that I think Rust people would argue is worth it, because it keeps you from having dangerous use after free bugs, but you know, it requires understanding a bunch of other things to do the same task you do in a language like C or C++, you know, and get the same kind of behavior as far as when is memory allocated and so on. And whether it's really zero overhead when you're thinking about that extra cost, maybe not. So that's where I'll finish up today. And next week, my plan is to talk about testing.